The U.S. Defense Department says it has no information to confirm that Iran is providing Russia with surface-to-surface missiles and more drones. North Korea says the recent artillery fire off its east and west coasts was a, quote, grave warning to the South to stop its provocations. And a new poll shows the US president's approval rating stays close to the lowest level of his presidency just 3 weeks from the midterm elections. Top story this hour, the United States says it cannot confirm reports of Russia receiving Iranian surface-to-surface missiles and more drones. The Pentagon says Washington does not have information of corroborating reports that Iran has promised to provide Russia with its missiles and drones. This after certain Western media claimed Moscow and Tehran had agreed in early October on the delivery of the Iranian weapons to Russia. Iran has once again rejected Western allegations about providing Russia with weapons and drones to be used in the war in Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson says such claims are based on false information. Nasser Kanani called the allegations part of political and purposeful media propaganda against the Islamic Republic. He also expressed Iran's readiness to talk with Ukraine to resolve the accusations. Earlier, Russian officials also roundly rejected any use of Iranian drones in Ukraine. Kiev and its Western allies claim that Russia has conducted a spate of attacks using Iran-made drones in recent weeks. In the meantime, Kiev says it is considering cutting all diplomatic ties with Tehran. That's as Iran had advised Ukraine to avoid being influenced by those who are seeking to destroy the relations. In yet another hostile move, the European Union has imposed sanctions on over a dozen Iranian officials and entities. That's over the accusation that Iran violated human rights while dealing with recent riots and vandalism there. In December 2020, the bloc adopted a policy to address serious rights violations and abuses worldwide. However, to do so, the EU would crucially need to comply with human rights itself.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh U.S. sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless.
The EU claims its anti-Iran sanctions are in response to what it calls crackdown on peaceful protests. Iranian officials say those who are responsible for vandalism, death and rioting cannot be categorized as peaceful protesters. Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of European governments' widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries.
The US, Canada and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, it's part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflicts. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
North Korea says it fired artillery shells toward its east and west coasts in a grave warning to the South Korea. Pyongyang says, quote, enemies should immediately stop provocative actions that cause military tension. According to the South Korean military, Pyongyang fired some 250 shells into the sea. North Korea's latest military activity comes just a day after the South kicked off its annual Hoguk defense drills. Seoul says, the joint maneuvers are aimed at boosting the ability of its troops to counter North Korea's nuclear threats. Pyongyang says the drills are a rehearsal for invasion. North Korea has repeatedly reacted by launching long and short-range missiles. 3 weeks from midterm elections in the United States, President Joe Biden's approval rating stays close to the lowest level during his presidency. A new poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos shows only 40% of Americans are satisfied with Biden's performance. The two-day national poll remains unchanged compared to last week. It shows about a third of Americans see economy as the principal problem facing the country. The respondents included both Democrats and Republicans. With the elections ahead, the new figure is raising the alarms that Democrats may lose control of the House of Representatives and the Senate. The United States is facing high inflation with many families struggling to cover expenses. Biden's popularity hit a record low of 36% in May and June. Ignoring mass protests in Haiti, which rejected foreign intervention, Washington says it will propose a non-UN mission authorizing to use military force in the Caribbean country. This as the United States is routinely accused of masterminding the assassination of Haiti's previous president. Ramin Mazari reports from Chicago.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
U.S. President Joe Biden will announce the release of 15 million barrels of strategic oil reserves in a bid to counter soaring energy prices ahead of midterm elections. A senior administration official has said more release would be likely in case of a spike in energy prices. The 15 million figure is the last part of 180 million barrels Biden ordered in March to release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The move comes about 2 weeks from after OPEC and its oil exporting allies announced a cut in oil production by 2 million barrels per day to boost prices. Biden first tapped the reserves last November amid a spike in gas prices and soaring inflation that was exacerbated by the Ukraine war. Saudi Arabia sentences a U.S. citizen to 16 years in jail over tweets critical of the kingdom in yet another case of the regime's crackdown on dissent. Saad Ibrahim Al-Mahdi was also given a travel ban for another 16 years. Al-Mahdi was arrested in November last year upon landing in Riyadh for a two-week stay to visit his family. He was detained for 11 months without trial. The 72-year-old is charged with supporting and funding terrorism and trying to destabilize the kingdom. Washington says it has raised concerns with Riyadh over the jail sentence. The State Department says the U.S. administration has consistently expressed concern with the case at senior levels. Saudi Arabia has a long history of human rights violations. In August, two Saudi women were sentenced to nearly 80 years in jail for their critical social media posts. Yemeni children remain the most affected segment of the society as the world's largest humanitarian crisis continues in the Arab country. Recent international reports say over 2 million Yemeni children are out of school, while nearly 3,000 schools have been damaged during the Saudi war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
And finally, the Russian military has warned that Kiev is planning to use what it called a prohibited means of waging war in southern Ukraine. Russian General Sergei Surovikin says the plan includes a massive strike on a strategic hydroelectric plant. The Russian commander says Kiev will launch massive rocket and artillery attacks on the city of Kherson. The Russian general warned such actions can lead to, quote, massive casualties among the civilian population. Kherson's governor has ordered the evacuation of civilians from four nearby towns. Russia captured the city of Kherson in the early days of war.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime, in a blatant and barbaric move, has authorized its military to kill Palestinians with drones in the West Bank. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Throughout website roads, commanders of the Israeli occupation forces, IOF, have been authorized to use armed drones to kill Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, with the approval of Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Aviv Kohavi. Hamas called the order a dangerous step and urged Palestinians to continue resisting the Israeli occupation with all means possible until they regain their legitimate rights. The authorization to expand the use of killer drones coincides with a significant rise in shooting attacks and massive gunfire during arrest raids, specifically in the northern West Bank cities of Jenin and Nablus, according to the Jerusalem Post. On September 28, the IOF killed 4 Palestinians and injured dozens more during protests in Jenin. Since as early as 2008, the Zionist regime Air Force has been killing Palestinians in Gaza with drones. They have also been used to fire gas bombs and live rounds in occupied Al-Quds. Although drones have been employed for surveillance, this is the first time armed drones will be utilized in the occupied West Bank. Drones comprise 80% of the total flight hours in the Zionist regime air force. But the Zionist regime has no right of self-defense against the people whose land it occupies. The Fourth Geneva Convention says that an occupying power has a legal duty to protect the occupied. As an occupying power, the fabricated regime of Israel cannot use military force against the occupied Palestinian people. Under international law, the Palestinians have a lawful right to resist the Zionist regime's occupation of their lands, including through armed struggle. In 1982, the UN General Assembly reaffirmed the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial and former and foreign domination and foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle. In May, Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqile, known as the Voice of Palestine, was reporting on an illegal IOF mass arrest raid on the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated by an Israeli regime sniper. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, ICC, classifies the targeting of war correspondents or journalists reporting from war zones or occupied territories by killing or physical assault as a war crime. Although the Zionist regime initially denied that an Israeli regime sniper shot Abu Aqile, it later said there was a high possibility that she was accidentally hit by IDF forces' gunfire.
We'll be right back.
On September 20, Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq and London-based research group Forensic Architecture issued a report finding that the Zionist regime forces repeatedly and deliberately targeted Abu Aqile with a well-aimed bullet. Her vest that said press was clearly visible to the IOF shooter, as shown by the detailed digital reconstruction from Al Jazeera footage. The same day that Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture released their report, the International Federation of Journalists, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, and the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate filed a complaint in the ICC on behalf of Abu Aqile family and journalist Alia Samoudi, who was also shot by IOF forces at the same time as Abu Aqile. Al-Haq is one of the six Palestinian human rights groups that the Zionist regime baselessly designated terrorist organizations and one of the seven raided by the IOF in August. The Zionist regime's assassination of Abu Aqile occurred just days after a coalition of Palestinian journalist organizations and leading human rights lawyers filed an initial complaint in the ICC protesting the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists. Jennifer Robinson, a lawyer for Abu Aqile family, said the killing of journalists is an attempt to cover up and prevent their work in documenting human rights abuse and fosters impunity for the injustices that they are seeking to cover. The Zionist regime's High Court of Justice effectively legalizes almost every act committed by the Zionist regime's security forces. Ishai Menochin, executive director of the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, wrote in the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. One can only conclude that Israel's HCJ is one of the primary enablers of the ongoing Israeli occupation of the occupied Palestinian territories. Another enabler of the Zionist regime's illegal occupation is the U.S. government, which provides the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion annually in military assistance. The Biden administration has refused to condemn the Zionist regime for its illegal terrorist designations and raids on the Palestinian human rights groups or its unlawful assassination of Abu Aqile. U.S. President Joe Biden has twice refused to meet with Abu Aqile's family face-to-face. Those who speak out against the Zionist regime's illegal occupation face serious consequences. Progressive journalist Katie Halper was censored and fired by The Hill for defending Representative Rashida Tlaib's description of the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have all characterized the system in the Zionist regime as apartheid. The Hill is owned by Nexstar Media Group, which calls itself America's largest local television and media company. Journalists who report the truth about the Zionist regime's crimes incur the risk of being fired or even assassinated. Neither the Zionist regime nor the U.S. government and its corporate media will tolerate any criticism of the illegal Israeli occupation.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, we have been discussing that how parents have to show off their emotions, how they have to show off their love through the emotions or the actions, because communication cannot be only through speaking. Speaking can be in many forms, in your words, in your body language, and that needs to be involving emotions and actions. I would want you to give us more examples, like how parents can show off this love to their children.
One of the issues that has to be taken into account is that basically the first faculty which is developed in a child is the listening skill.
Okay.
So a child, even in the womb of the mother, is capable of listening to things.
Yeah.
And the first stage in picking up any language by a child is also through listening.
Yeah.
Then goes on to speaking. Then he can start reading, and then he can start writing maybe at a later stage.
Yeah.
So in child development, listening is very important. And through that listening, his emotions and feelings are also invoked.
Okay.
The words that he listens to, the sounds that she listens to, they evoke many feelings.
Okay.
So that is important, what types of words and what types of sounds are coming to the child.
I was even reading a couple of days ago a study, a new research, wherein it was saying that even the child in womb reacts to what mother eats. Like if a mother eats carrots, a child smiles. Or if a mother eats, say for example, the brinjals, the child makes faces or something. So when a child in the womb can even react to these things, what mother eats, it shows us that a child has been listening and he has been definitely reacting to whatever he's listening, basically.
Yes, so when it comes to communication and talking, the first thing is listening.
Yeah.
He or she listens to words. Therefore, it's very much recommended that a mother recites the Holy Quran during pregnancy. That has a very beautiful effect on the child. So one of the things, as I mentioned, listening and feelings involved as a result. So we need to develop positive feelings, inculcate positive emotions in the child. So things which he or she listens to are very important. The words, even music, even singing, even whatever we are talking about, whatever sounds and voices, he or she picks them up. He or she is very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the child. He or she can understand in one what tone the words are being spoken.
Exactly.
He or she can very much understand if the parent or the mother is angry or is worried or is in a state of stress.
Okay.
So because it's of that listening capacity, that has developed to a very high degree.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be very careful.
All right.
In what we say, in what we say, the choice of words. Let me give you something very important, which is very important in the sense that tomorrow when this child is going to develop into a grown-up, he needs to be able to communicate properly. True. Use yeah. the use of any language, in any language he or she communicates, he or she should be using the proper words, the proper sentences, grammatically correct. Eloquent sentences.
Yeah.
And where does that start? From the warm, from the listening that the child is...
Charity begins at home.
...is exposed to yeah. at home.
Yeah.
So if a mother or parents don't know how to speak properly, even their own tongue,
yeah.
how do we expect the child to pick it up?
Yeah. I'll discuss more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi. We are discussing how parents can educate their child through their emotions, through their actions. Well, Professor Nakavi, there are some parents who, at the age of very, say, 3 or 4, force basically their children, even Muslim parents, to actually pick up, to basically... actually memorize Quran. Do you think that's okay?
In my humble opinion, no, that's not a good strategy at all. Basically, what has been very much impressed upon, emphasized in the various ahadith which we have, it is something common that we say that the Holy Prophet of Islam has very explicitly said that in the first 7 years of the child's life, there shouldn't be any formal education.
All right.
That's my understanding. When it's said that the child is a king in the first 7 years, he's a servant in the second 7 years, and the third, he becomes an advisor, a vizier. My understanding is for the first 7 years, there has to be no direct education.
No direct formal education.
Formal education okay. is out of bounds. Yes, there has to be learning, but it should be completely informal.
Okay.
Putting the child into a classroom environment and making him learn...
Putting pressure on him, basically.
Pressure to do it, it's completely incorrect.
Yeah, I was just...
It should be done... Yes, if you want him or her to pick up the Quran, provide him an environment
mm-hmm.
where... he or she is listening to the Quran, and
because
he or she will
start. Basically, first
he will listen and memorize. How do you? I mean, you see that many of our children, they pick up songs. They pick up a lot of
any other music
when they hear songs, music,
the pop, the classic,
whatever type of music. This listening is so effective that they pick up, memorize those things.
Yeah.
In a natural way. It should be done in a very natural way. If I want my child to pick up the Quran with a when we teach children ourselves or even employ some teachers to teach them, many of the teachers even don't have the proper accent to teach them Arabic.
Exactly.
But if you, for example, a child is exposed to continuous, any sort of sound.
Any audio listening.
Audio listening, videos,
he may
games,
learn very soon.
He himself will pick up the rhymes, yeah. The nursery rhymes. How does a child pick up the nursery rhymes?
True. We'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi. We're discussing how parents can educate their children through their emotions and actions, which are extremely important as a communication, as a part of communication, as we say, speaking. The speaking is an important skill in the same way. Showing that love through your emotions and actions is actually equally important. Well, Professor Naqavi, you were saying that a child should not be forced. Let me tell our audiences that I was just talking to a psychologist yesterday who said that we had a case. And there was a guy who was elder, who was like in his 20s, and his parents came and they were upset with him because they said that he would go out at night, take out a car, and only move around the roads. He won't listen to music. He won't be picking up anyone. He won't be going anywhere. But he would just be roaming around on the roads. And then when they verify the case, what has actually happened, the psychologists come to the point, go back to his childhood, and then they realize that the child was forced to memorize Quran at the age of 4. And since that, he was given a very formal and tough education at a very, very early age. He missed a lot of things, and now this missing thing he was finding in the roads, and which even he could not find in the later age. So you also recommend our parents that not to do that.
Exactly. The problem, you know, what is the problem out there? The problem out there is that our parents are very much concerned that they, especially our expats who are living in the West.
Don't you think many of them want to do it for the show-off?
Show-off is important. That is what I'm coming to. That's what I'm saying. They are very much concerned with their identity as being Muslims.
Okay.
And they think that being a Muslim, a good Muslim, is being able to recite the Quran properly. Yes, it is a part of it, but it's not all of it. That's a compartmentalization of religion into very specific things, as I've been saying from the beginning.
Okay.
Islam is not just reciting the Quran and offering prayers properly. That's one part of our
that's
being good human.
That's important, but that's a part of
but
it.
But that has become the identity of, that is what the identity which we want to identify ourselves and our children. We say, oh, let our child finish off the Quran at that age, and we have a bismillah at the beginning, and at the end we have a program.
And the society will be praising us.
And if the society doesn't, if he does so, if he's able to recite the Quran off by heart, everyone will be praising, and look how good a Muslim parent I am. That
True.
Is the problem.
So basically you're doing that for yourself. You have to be very much concerned that whatever you're teaching to your child, that should be for the child himself, not for your own praises and other things that or not for any kind of show off. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way. complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Liz Truss is fighting for her political survival, with MPs in her own Conservative Party threatening to oust her. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Prime Minister Liz Truss is fighting for her political survival, with Conservative MPs threatening to oust her and even allies warning she has just days to turn around her premiership, despite ripping up her economic strategy and appointing Jeremy Hunt as the new Chancellor. The beleaguered Prime Minister will attempt to shore up her crumbling support by gathering her cabinet ministers at No. 10 Downing Street on Monday evening and then embarking on a series of meetings with mutinous Tory MPs before the next budget in a fortnight's time. After crisis talks at Chequers over their new fiscal plan on Sunday, Jeremy Hunt insisted that Liz Truss was still in charge despite her increasingly perilous position, as he warned of further public spending cuts and failed to rule out more U-turns on her disastrous mini-budget, including scrapping the 1p cut to the income tax base rate. Ministers will wait anxiously for the markets to open, the first test of whether Liz Truss's decision to sack Kwasi Kwarteng as Chancellor and tear up her mini-budget will be enough, amid fears that the sterling could head towards parity with the US dollar and rising bond yields put upward pressure on mortgage rates. The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, increased pressure on Liz Truss, calling on her to make an urgent House of Commons statement on Monday, with party insiders saying that they would do everything possible to force her to come. The Prime Minister says she is in charge, but the evidence this weekend suggests she is in office but not in power, he said. An opinion poll by Opinium for the Trade Union Congress, TUC, using the MRP method to estimate constituency-level results, projected a 1997-style landslide victory for Labour, with the party winning 411 seats. It suggests the Conservatives would lose 219 seats to end up with just 137 seats, with the Liberal Democrats on 39 seats and the Scottish Nationalist Party on 37. With 10 cabinet ministers, including Jeremy Hunt, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Therese Coffey, losing their seats in a general election, along with former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Meanwhile, plotting at Westminster continued with a group of senior Conservative MPs, many of them supporters of Rishi Sunak, planning to meet on Monday night for a dinner hosted by ex-Treasury Minister Mel Stride, amid speculation that as many as 100 no-confidence letters have been submitted to Sir Graham Brady, chairman of the Backbench 1922 Committee. The veteran Tory MP Crispin Blunt was the first to go public in calling for Liz Truss to step down, saying he did not think the Prime Minister could survive the current crisis. Crispin Blunt said, "I think the game is up and it's now a question as to how the succession is managed." The former minister, who was the first MP to call for Ian Duncan Smith to quit as party leader back in May of 2003, told Channel 4 News, "If there is such a weight of opinion in the parliamentary party that we have to have a change, then it will be affected. Exactly how it is done and exactly under what mechanism, but it will happen." Another backbencher, Jamie Wallace, who entered parliament in 2019, broke cover and joined the call for Liz Truss to quit, confirming to The Guardian that he had submitted a letter of no confidence. "In recent weeks, I have watched as the government has undermined Britain's economic credibility and fractured our party irreparably. Enough is enough. I have written to the Prime Minister to ask her to stand down, as she no longer holds the confidence of this country," he said. Later on Sunday, Andrew Bridgen told the Daily Telegraph, "We cannot carry on like this. Our country, its people and our party deserve better." As she tries to stave off open rebellion, Liz Truss will this week continue her meetings with small groups of Tory backbenchers as she desperately tries to convince them to back her, while Jeremy Hunt will hold a series of roundtables on the economy for MPs. However, Downing Street insiders acknowledge the Prime Minister's position was extremely fragile. Her decision to bring Jeremy Hunt on board buys us some time. "The budget will look very different now, but we're taking one day at a time," one said. Another government insider suggested that it would be one hell of a gamble for Tory MPs to try to oust the Prime Minister when there was no obvious successor to take over from her. But one leading rebel said, "I don't see how Liz Truss can survive. Jeremy Hunt is a good man, but her credibility is below zero." The executive of the 1922 committee will meet on Wednesday as usual, with members expected to discuss the precariousness of the Prime Minister's position. The Reuters news agency gives us more details about the same story. It was a bruising meeting with her Conservative lawmakers this week that finally shook Prime Minister Liz Truss's earlier unwavering faith that she could weather the market fallout from her radical economic growth plan. 2 days later, a chastened Liz Truss addressed her first news conference as Prime Minister to admit she had gone further and faster than markets expected, and sacked her friend and finance minister Kwasi Kwarteng to try to appease her lawmakers. Offering little in the way of apology, Liz Truss instead insisted her government could not give up on economic growth, but would slow the pace and bring on board more centrist lawmakers to quell a rebellion in her party. She also dropped another of her pledges to scrap a planned increase in corporation tax to try to calm markets, which had balked at the size of her spending plans, combined with a lack of detail about how they would be paid for. With her credibility in tatters, she is now fighting for her political survival. "I want to deliver a low-tax, high-wage, high-growth economy. It's what I was elected by my party to do. That mission remains, she told news conference in a low voice, absent of the bravado that marked her appearances in a leadership campaign. But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change. We need to act now to reassure the markets of our fiscal discipline. It was a low-key, almost solemn performance from a politician who bounded on stage and lapped up the applause from the party faithful during the leadership campaign when she beat her rival Rishi Sunak to become Prime Minister on 6th of September. Then, buoyed by her victory, she felt she had no need to appoint anyone but her loyal supporters to a cabinet team of top ministers, irritating some lawmakers who felt she should have tried to do more to unite the party. Yet the signs were already there. She had won fewer votes than Rishi Sunak from lawmakers in earlier rounds of the leadership contest, and those who did not back her were quick to criticise her first steps in the role. When Liz Truss unveiled her economic programme on 23rd of September and the markets plunged, that criticism grew, and even those who had supported her wondered out loud why she had failed to prepare not only the markets but the country for the scale of her tax-cutting plans. She explained to lawmakers she had to act quickly to help families and businesses with skyrocketing energy bills, but few understood why her economic program had to be launched at exactly the same time. A misstep, she later admitted. But instead of trying to bring in frustrated lawmakers, those closest to her said she pressed on with her plan in her Downing Street office, convinced the markets had overreacted and would calm down when they understood what she wanted to achieve.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.